Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The most delayed regularly scheduled airline flight in this country is Delta Connection, flight number 5042, Philadelphia to New York's JFK. Scheduled flight time, about a half an hour. Average delay, about a half an hour. But the president said today he wants to fix the unfriendly skies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Academy of Family Physicians. Personal preventive care for better patient health and reduced costs for business. AAFP.org/value. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management. Committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the studios of Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 15th of November. Great to have you here. And I am happy to say I made it to Michigan right on time this morning. Punctuality is one of the few joys of taking the red eye. Going home tomorrow afternoon could turn out quite the worst, though. According to the airline industry, Friday is the start of the Thanksgiving travel rush. 27 million people are going to be flying next week. And the threat of an aviation meltdown has forced the president's hand. At the White House today, the president announced he's going to open up what are essentially express lanes in the air over military bases along the heavily traveled East Coast. He's ordered a holiday moratorium on FAA maintenance projects to help more flights stay on schedule. Oh, and he wants some long-term regulatory changes, too. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
By next summer, President Bush wants to double the compensation airlines must pay to passengers who are bumped from overbooked flights. A customer forced to wait more than 2 hours, for example, would receive a minimum of $800.
We want people who are responsible for moving passengers to understand that there will be consequences for these delays. All aiming to get the system to work better.
During the first 8 months of the year, more than 52,000 U.S. passengers were involuntarily bumped from overbooked flights. The airlines say overbookings are a necessary part of their business. Susan Elliott is with Delta Airlines.
We need to be able to overbook flights because thousands of people don't show up for our flights every day. Now, of course, 99% of the time we do get it right, but on the rare occasions we get it wrong, we do our best to accommodate those passengers, and we don't feel that an increased fee is an appropriate action.
Overbookings are one way airlines fill their seats with passengers. Jonathan Spira, a contributing editor with Business Traveler magazine, doubts doubling the penalty will be much of a disincentive.
I think that the airlines will see this as just part of the cost of doing business and will factor this in to the cost to the flying public.
Spira says that won't boost ticket prices much because most passengers voluntarily give up seats in exchange for free tickets later. For a longer-term solution, the Bush administration wants a modernized air traffic control system and higher fees on airlines that use airports and airspace during peak congested periods. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Congested periods like the Friday before Thanksgiving, so let's all just keep our fingers crossed that I get home on time, huh? If you want to scare the bejesus out of a Wall Street money market fund manager, all you have to do is mention this phrase, breaking the buck. It's kind of an insider's reference to the value of a fund falling below a dollar a share, which is all but officially verboten. But it has apparently happened to a bond fund managed by General Electric. It's not a money market fund per se, but it is pretty close. So the news set off some alarm bells in the financial press today. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Last week, GE Asset Management sent an email to investors in its enhanced cash fund. The message offered them a chance to get their money back, at least most of it. The fund had lost money on mortgage-backed securities. And given the potential for further losses, GE spokesman Russell Wilkerson says all investors outside GE took the offer.
We wanted to make them aware of the current market conditions and give them the option of taking out 96 cents on the dollar. They looked at the market and evaluated it from their perspective and thought that was the right option for them.
Wilkerson says the investors walked away about $24 million poorer in all. Pretty small potatoes, actually. These are big-time institutional investors. They knew the fund could lose money. But when the business press reported the losses, people started to worry. An enhanced cash fund like GE's acts a bit like a money market mutual fund. Managers rarely let their fund's asset value slip below a dollar a share. Bank of America, Legg Mason, and Wachovia have all put up extra cash recently to keep their money market funds from breaking the buck. Peter Crane tracks the industry for Crane Data. He says it's worth the expense.
They're doing it because it's much cheaper than seeing their mutual fund franchise deteriorate.
So far, Crane says investors don't seem to be abandoning money market funds. Last week, the funds passed the $3 trillion mark for the first time. And in their 37-year history, only one money market fund has collapsed. Investors lost just 6 cents on the dollar. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It's going to be a busy couple of days in Cape Town, South Africa. There's a U.S.-Africa business summit there today. The U.S. is still the largest investor in the continent, although China's gaining fast. Tomorrow, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson arrive for a meeting of what's known as the G20. Finance leaders from industrialized countries and some of the major emerging economies, places like China, India, and Brazil. Gretchen Wilson reports from Johannesburg. Africa is getting more attention now thanks to a strain on global resources.
Though Africa is generally known as a poor continent, it's rich in natural resources, from oil and natural gas to copper, gold, and platinum. And African countries are rapidly selling off these commodities to the rest of the world at high prices.
Generally in Africa, we're finding that commodity-producing countries are certainly benefiting unambiguously from the current environment.
That's Jeff Gable, head of research at Absa Capital in Johannesburg. He says it looks like commodity prices will be robust for a long time.
This is the strongest economic growth that we've seen in a very long time. And what's happening is we're running out of stuff. So as demand increases, demand for energy, demand for raw commodities increases, the supply response has not been as rapid. Markets are much tighter now than they used to be, and you see that in just about everything.
And that's what delegates to the G20 summit are anxious to discuss, because commodity price changes affect importers and exporters differently. For example, Angola's seen massive growth thanks to its oil exports. Just next door, Zambia exports copper, and Botswana exports diamonds. But these economies still struggle to keep pace with soaring oil prices. Economist Adrian Saville of Cannon Asset Management.
They might be exporting other commodities, but in order to export these other commodities, they need to import very expensive oil.
It's the catch-22 that the world's finance ministers and central bank governors will discuss for the first time at this weekend's summit. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
A quick follow-up to a story we told you about yesterday, a story that turned into less than it first appeared. The Associated Press had reported that United and Delta Airlines were in merger talks. Delta shot down the news as nothing more than rumors. Today on Capitol Hill, Delta CEO Richard Anderson told Congress he has no idea where that leak came from. As it happens, Anderson was in Washington to talk about aviation congestion, the topic the president addressed today. There was no joy on Wall Street this afternoon. Traders were uninspired by this morning's report on consumer inflation, which was itself uninspiring. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Only in the world of international finance is a write-down of $2.7 billion described as a tolerable loss. The British bank Barclays clued us in to its subprime losses today, the aforementioned $2.7 billion. Barclays is just the latest to report losses due to the U.S. housing meltdown. Congress is doing its part to make sure the whole thing doesn't happen again. The House is set to vote today on a bill that would lay down some rules for lending. Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
3 years ago, Lucy Hadley was looking for a condo. She'd been saving up, and the market was going gangbusters. But it wasn't easy to buy in super expensive Los Angeles. Hadley had excellent credit, but her salary was on the low side, so her bank wouldn't offer her the roughly $400,000 she needed to buy a one-bedroom apartment.
I didn't know any credit cards or anything, because I'm kind of sticky about that kind of stuff. I couldn't understand why I couldn't get a loan.
So Hadley turned to a small subprime lender. She says she started getting uncomfortable when she saw how the lender was trying to qualify her for the loan she wanted.
They find money that you don't even know you have. They looked at my savings, my 401k and all that. They include all of that, and they consider that part of your income. And they would say stuff like, you know, you're a prime area, and property's going to keep going up and up and up, and you'll be building up equity.
The interest on Hadley's loan will soon triple to more than 11%, and her condo has gone down in value. Now Congress has introduced a bill aimed at the kind of practices that landed Hadley in this trouble. Democratic Congressman Melvin Watt says the House bill will help protect people from getting sucked into loans they can't afford.
If we set rules of the road that apply at the federal level, basically what we've done is set a minimum standard that would apply across the board.
The House bill would make it illegal for lenders to reward brokers for giving out subprime loans and require that borrowers meet minimum standards. It would also prevent things like prepayment penalties that punish people for paying loans back early. The thing is, a lot of the organizations doling out the shadiest loans were not banks, and they won't have to follow federal rules. David LaRay is the former chief economist for the National Association of Realtors.
It was the mortgage brokerage companies that were out there trying to sell a lot of these irresponsible type loans.
Still, LaRay says reining in the banks will make a big difference. That's because there won't be many organizations left to buy up risky loans from lenders like Countrywide. LaRay says the bill is also an important feel-good measure. He says Wall Street is watching Capitol Hill and Congress needs to act.
If there isn't any legislation, it's going to prolong the contraction that we're currently experiencing in real estate. So any type of legislation that's going in a positive direction for the real estate industry is good legislation at this juncture.
Meanwhile, homeowner Lucy Hadley needs to take out another loan to cover her new mortgage payments, but she's scared she'll end up in an even deeper hole.
I don't know how high my loan could go. I really don't. You know, with all that paperwork, I don't understand. I know that it's going to be difficult, so.
Hadley says she'll do everything she can not to foreclose. She doesn't want to lose the money she's already invested. The Center for Responsible Lending estimates Americans will lose more than $9 billion a year because of predatory mortgages. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The generals who run Burma's military junta are also some of the world's biggest gem dealers. They control a company known as Myanmar Gem Enterprise. The company is holding its big auction in Rangoon this week. Precious stones bring in nearly $300 million to the Burmese economy every year, but the haul might be a little bit lower this time around. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has the story.
If you own a ruby, chances are pretty good it comes from Burma, since about 90% of the red stones on the market come from there. Not surprisingly, gemstones are one of the biggest moneymakers for the country. Only natural gas and timber are bigger. Fancy names like Tiffany and Cartier have joined the European Union in its boycott of Burmese gemstones. The question is whether jewelers can force political change. Dan Slater is a political scientist at the University of Chicago. He says the way to force change in Burma is to make the government talk to the opposition.
So one question is whether or not more economic pain visited on the junta will have that effect. And a second question is to what extent the gem sector is big enough of a factor to be able to induce the kind of economic pain that might induce the junta to do so.
So far, economic sanctions haven't worked because China and India keep doing business there. Where these latest sanctions might have an effect, though, is in the U.S., on jewelers and jewelry wearers. Brian Lieber runs his family's jewelry business in the Chicago area. He quit buying Burmese gems in 2002 to protest the regime. He says the Burmese rubies cost more, but that could change.
By cutting off the supply of Burmese origin rubies, I think finer quality stones from other places in the globe probably will increase somewhat in value.
It may soon be impossible to legally get Burmese gems in the U.S. Congress is trying to close the loophole that had made the precious stones exempt from the ban on imports from Burma. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Afghan-American Chamber of Commerce met this week in Washington. A quick rundown of the list of invitees gives you some idea of what was on the agenda. Carlos Gutierrez, the Secretary of Commerce, was there. Afghan business leaders, too. Also, American trade and development officials. The chamber's trying to raise foreign investment in Afghanistan. They're not having much luck while the shooting's still going on, but they do have some ideas they're working on. Paul Brandis has more.
Could it be that the U.S. strategy for winning the war on terror depends on almonds, apricots, and pomegranates?
Right now, we think the practical thing is to take the low-hanging fruit, literally and figuratively. Afghan farmers are past masters at growing certain kinds of crops profitably.
That's Jim Kunder of the U.S. Agency for International Development, who's helping Afghan farmers export fruits and nuts. But he acknowledges Afghan farmers are masters at growing another crop, too, poppy. Poppy accounts for a third of Afghanistan's GDP. It's also used to make opium and heroin and helps finance the Taliban's war against the U.S. And that's where the war on drugs intersects with the war on terror, says Bill Piper of the Drug Policy Alliance.
Current U.S. policy towards the poppy fields in Afghanistan, just going in and burning them down and alienating the farmers, is driving a lot of Afghan people into the hands of our enemies.
Why destroy poppy, asks Piper, when it can be used to make legal drugs that are in demand around the world, like Vicodin and OxyContin? The European Parliament agrees. It's proposing to work with the Afghan government to use poppy for legal medicinal uses. That's a strategy it says would also dent the Taliban's financing. The U.S. government's Kunder says the idea is interesting, but it's not something the administration is considering now. Other countries are getting into the poppy for medicine business, notably Turkey and Australia. They're growing it on their own. In Washington, I'm Paul Brandis for Marketplace.
Coming up, more of our series Consumed. Will the economy of tomorrow look like the good old days?
We see a sustainable global economy as a network of local living economies.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks stayed on the downswing today thanks to concerns about consumer spending. The Dow Industrials lost 120 points, 0.9%. Close at 13,110. The NASDAQ slid nearly 1% 25 points to end at 26,18. The S&P 500 ended the day down nearly 1.3%, 19 points at 1,451. The Dow Jones Sustainability World Index dropped more than 1.5%, 21 points to close at 1,392. Our Consumed series looks at the local food movement today. We thought we'd see how the biggest food importers and processors might be doing. Not so well, it seems. Tyson Foods dropped 4%. Kraft Foods lost 1.8%. Chiquita Brands of banana fame slipped 0.3%. Fresh Del Monte Produce traded flat to just, you know, a little bit higher. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529. By Consumed, American Public Media's special series exploring the sustainability of our consumer culture. Online at consumed.publicradio.org. And by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at shrinersforkids.org. You're listening to Consumed, a special multi-show collaboration from American Public Media. It's about the future of the consumer economy. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it sustainable? The product of a year's work by teams of reporters, you'll want to catch all of this provocative series. Coming all week on Marketplace, Marketplace Morning Report, Speaking of Faith, and Weekend America.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Congressional Budget Office holds its 2007 Directors Conference on Climate Change. Bubbly is uncorked in San Francisco to celebrate the opening of Mint Plaza. It's a stretch of city adjacent to the old U.S. Mint that's gotten a $3.5 million green facelift. And learn more about the people who grow your food during National Farm City Week, annually the week before Thanksgiving. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal, and we are back to Consumed, our series on the consumer economy, airing on this and some other American public media programs. We live in the world's most modern and convenient economy. If you want something within your means, all you have to do is go out and buy it. Convenient doesn't always mean smart, though. Our sustainability reporter Sam Eaton checked out some people who think they've come up with a better way to organize an economy. Whether it's modern or not depends on your point of view.
The wooded outskirts of Bellingham, Washington may not look like the epicenter for a new economic model, but looks and sounds can be deceiving.
My name's Wesley Smith. I'm one of the owners of Smith & Valley Woodworks. We build out of locally harvested woods primarily.
Smith is an old-fashioned furniture maker who keeps his customers and his suppliers local.
We call our neighbor Dwayne for another tree, and we can hear the chainsaws running, and we can hear the tree hit the ground, and we know our tree's ready.
Smith says keeping all the steps of production within a quarter mile of his workshop is not only better for the planet, it reduces his transportation costs considerably.
The cheapest input, you know, I mean, it could be just right in your backyard. You know, it doesn't have to come from an Indonesian forest.
Now, if you took this neighborly business-to-business relationship across an entire town, you'd have a self-sustaining local economy. Then imagine that model spread around the world and you're glimpsing the revolutionary vision of the new buy local movement. It's anti-globalization on a global scale. The movement has even begun to spawn conferences with standing room only.
Our vision is not to just have strong groups in Bellingham and Boulder, Colorado, and Madison, Wisconsin, the places where you might imagine that this would take root, but to go well beyond that. And we see a sustainable global economy as a network of local living economies.
Don Schaefer heads the movement's main trade group, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or BALI. He says these local economies add up to a $40 billion sector, and they're growing fast.
There's a lot of talk about local economies being kind of the next green or the next organic.
In order to be self-sustaining, some towns have minted their own currencies, which can only be used to buy local products. There are even efforts underway to create local stock exchanges.
We want this to be a real model, a real example of what's possible.
Michelle Long heads the Bellingham nonprofit Sustainable Connections, which promotes local businesses and markets. She says the Pacific Northwest, with its cornucopia of forests, farms, and fisheries, is uniquely suited to lead this economic revolution.
We have this place where we can really have our own economy and reimagine things from the ground up. So we can look at how can we grow and distribute food? How do we shelter ourselves? How do we power our lives? How do we define success in business?
Long takes me on a tour of Bellingham's historic Fairhaven neighborhood. This cluster of restored brick buildings has become a petri dish for self-sustaining local economies.
As you can see, there's lots of activity, lots of people in the streets, lots of things going on. People living here, people working here, people shopping here. Well, you can see a thriving community.
Environmental writer Bill McKibben has become the movement's de facto spokesman. He says this scene of bustling local businesses isn't just feel-good. It's the very foundation of modern economics.
Adam Smith was describing exactly the kind of local economies that I'm talking about in his work, you know, his famous butcher and baker and things enriching themselves were members of a circumscribed local economy.
McKibben rejects criticism that he's an idealist who just wants to turn back the clock to 19th century localism. The utopians, he says, are the ones who think our rates of consumption can keep on growing forever. McKibben says environmental pressures such as global warming and diminishing resources have a timetable of their own.
We're going to end up in more localized and rugged economies than we have at the moment. And we're either going to do it because we decide that it'd be nice to do it, or because we don't have much choice, and it'll probably be some combination of the two.
In Bellingham, Washington, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
A lot of the suggested fixes for what ails the consumer economy have a distinct Back to the Future ring about them, that somehow we have to return to the economic models of the 19th century to make it to the 22nd. Not everybody buys that argument, of course. Commentator David Frum among them.
You've just heard from people who think the key to human survival is to cut ourselves off from the world economy and buy and sell only in local markets. This approach has been tried before, in Europe, after the fall of the Roman Empire. We call this period the Dark Ages. Papyrus from Egypt disappeared from north of the Alps, and people reverted to writing on animal skins. Grain from Gaul stopped arriving in Rome, and the population of the city dwindled from over a million to a few thousand. For the next millennium, a local crop failure brought famine and death. Europe and North America left that world behind in the 19th century, and much of the rest of the planet is now following. The past 15 years have seen the most dramatic reduction of poverty in the history of the human race, as hundreds of millions of Chinese and South Asians have rejoined the global trading system. Yet some worry it cannot continue, that we'll pollute ourselves to death or run out of resources. These worries ignore both evidence and history. Human ingenuity creates resources as fast as we consume them. Believe it or not, the proven oil reserves of the United States today are virtually identical to what they were in 1973. As for pollution, the richer we get, the cleaner we get. Virtually every lake and river in the United States is cleaner than it was a generation ago. Ditto the air in any major city. Richer people demand cleaner environments. And unlike, say, medieval villagers, they can afford to pay for them. Which is not to argue against buying local produce. I do it whenever I can. It's tastier. It's also more expensive. But thanks to the wealth produced by ever-expanding technology and world trade, I can afford it. After two or three more decades of growth through trade, so I hope will millions more in this country and throughout the world.
David Frum worked as a speechwriter for President Bush. He's now a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. For more on the Buy Local movement and some other ways to reduce your footprint on this planet of ours, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. By Siemens, from strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note for the wordsmiths among you. Every year, the editors of the new Oxford American Dictionary choose a word of the year. Lexicographers gather at Oxford University to debate which new entry best captures the mood of the times. And the 2000 winner was announced this week. And here's the marketplace angle. I know you've been waiting for it. It's locavore, those who only eat locally produced food. The term was apparently coined 2 years ago by a group of women in San Francisco who urged residents there to restrict their diets to food grown or produced within 100 miles of home. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow heaved off 120 points, about 0.9%. The NASDAQ drooped 25 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 slid down 19 points, nearly 1.3% there. Our editors include Kevin Artovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on Consumed.
If every Walmart shopper, all 180 million of us, would buy one of these, it would be like taking a million cars off the road.
Can Walmart save the world? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.